This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should be watching these movies,
but we're here to see if they're right.
Join us as we take a cinematic journey through independent and classic film.
So dim the lights
and get ready for the show.
This is Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. Welcome to the podcast that will get you across enemy lines. This is the Movie Dude Eric, and along with me are...
This is Kent, and I had something witty and planned involving a silent podcast, but then I was reminded of blogs and just went, oh, okay, never mind.
Hey, this is Chris, and I'm a disgrace to the South.
In this episode, we're discussing The General, starring Buster Keaton, Marion Mack, Glenn Cavender, Jim Farley, and directed by Clyde Bruckman and Buster Keaton. All right, gentlemen, we are coming back to silent films. I think it's been, at least 2 years since we've talked about a silent film.
That was Metropolis, correct?
I think that was the last Daughter one. Of Dawn was our last one.
Oh, that's right, Daughter of Dawn. Okay. Yeah. How did I forget that?
This is our first comedy, silent comedy.
Really?
And normally when you think of silent comedy, I think the big one of them all is Charlie Chaplin. But Buster Keaton is the number two, and Harold Lloyd is definitely number three. But although he's probably my all-time favorite. But out of curiosity, Chris, since this is your first silent film with us, what is your familiarity?
I've seen a handful of them, mostly Charlie Chaplin stuff, seen Metropolis. This is my first Buster Keaton movie, so, yeah.
So what about you, Kent? Is this your first Buster Keaton?
It is my first silent comedy in general.
Oh,
really?
Yeah.
So, I guess since this is your first time coming into a silent comedy, especially with all the dramas that we've done so far for Art House Legends, out of curiosity, what do you think is one of the strengths of having a silent comedy in comparison to a drama? Well, what do you think works on that level?
The good silent comedian can make the joke work without having to have you read the screen constantly. Some of the dramas you have to go, okay, can we get a card here so I can figure out what's going on? Okay, thanks. Okay, blah, 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 blah. I get it now. The comedies, it's just stuff happens and you're like, oh my god, did that really happen? Okay, I don't have to know what they're saying. I just have to see what happened around them.
Well, comedy, by its nature, is very physical. When it comes to even a wordy comedy, a witty comedy, there is some physical elements that you have to kind of bring broad. And like when we talked about Spaceballs, there's a lot of grand gestures, grand pronouncements, lots of arm movement, things of that nature that kind of broaden the stakes a little bit when it comes to that. And when it comes to comedy, comedy is kind of vaudevillian, which is something that was around at the same time as the silent comedies. And a lot of the silent comedians come from vaudeville. So there's a lot of physical pratfalls and joke humor in that particular sense. And obviously this is something that has lived on beyond both vaudeville and the silent comedy. In fact, if you think about it, most of today's greatest comedians or great physical performers have kind of the same dexterity and the same kind of attention to detail as you would see with, say, a Charlie Chaplin or a Buster Keaton. And Chris, I'm pretty sure that you can kind of back me up on this, considering a lot of the physical comedy that you see even in today's movies, right?
Right.
But I think also another aspect when it comes to especially Buster Keaton, and to an extent Charlie Chaplin, although I think Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd are even better at this, is kind of using setting and stage and presentation of the environment. The environment itself plays a large part in the comedic aspect of what's happening in the film. And especially when you have the general. The general is very... I mean, just from the... You know, from the concept, this could be both very fun and funny, but I could also see being very daunting as a comedic type film, right? I mean, you're basically stuck. If you're kind of going with the premise of you have an engineer who's chasing a train engineer who's chasing another train, and hijinks ensue. Yeah, there are stuff you can do, but you'd also be kind of daunted with the limited space that you would have with a train, right?
No, he makes it work with making it the whole adventure down the... A lot of it's the adventure down the tracks. A lot of it is the mistakes that happen when you're the sole operator.
Well, that's very true.
Yeah.
But, okay, so let's go ahead and let's talk about the general itself, the film itself. Now, the film is set during the Civil War, and this is something that I actually only found out very recently, but this is actually based on a true story. This actually happened. Did y'all know this going into this movie?
I was wondering that. You'd mentioned something about it, but I didn't get a chance to research it.
So there was, in fact, a Confederate engineer who was not allowed to sign up for military service, and who he just happened to be taking a quick break to wash his hands when a couple of defectors to the north stole his train, and he chased them down and got it back and was able to stop a northern raid from happening. And while there's a lot of things that didn't happen that this movie puts out, you can definitely tell the aspects that are definitely Hollywoodish. But there's even stuff that happened in real life that didn't even happen in the movie that would have been almost to the point of obviously it'd be too good to be true. Where, in fact, you know, the train that Buster Keaton was chasing was actually going backwards. And that he was chasing a train that was going kind of in the wrong direction. But, yeah, I thought that was kind of insane that this is something that actually happened. But, out of curiosity, though, did the fact that the main protagonist is a Confederate engineer, a loyal Confederate, did that have any impact on what you thought of the character or the situation?
It, you know, oddly, it didn't for me. He was just a working class guy. He wasn't high up. He wasn't anything. He was just doing his job. And here comes a war. So...
Well, no, I mean, he does firmly believe in the Confederate way of life.
Well, yeah. Well, he believes in... He has a patriotism for the South. That's whether true. Or not that extends to, yes, its own people, doesn't get touched on.
This movie is painfully apolitical.
Yeah.
There is no discussion whatsoever
of
politics.
But for the most part, in this film, he's like, oh no, they stole my train. Oh no, they also stole my girl. That's a very universal thing.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're the Union, I mean, the right thing for gentlemen Union troops to do would be, you know, okay, nobody even looks at this girl. In fact, let's hand her over to some nurses on our side and just say, okay, you girls guard her, whatever, we're doing this attack tomorrow. No men around her at all. Just preserve her. What do they call it in the South? Her honor, and just make sure that whenever she gets back to her dad, we can honestly say, okay, yeah.
Well, that would be completely dishonest, historically speaking. I mean, the thing is that both the North and South have had their fair share of atrocities, and
which is true, yeah.
Especially when it comes to the rules of war. In fact, you could almost say that
it's some before of the Geneva Convention, so who cares?
Well, the Geneva Conventions is a 20th century thing.
Yeah.
So there's that.
Yeah.
But no, the thing is that the fact is that the bad guys are the bad guys, the good guys are the good guys. It sets up who the characters are and that they're on opposite sides of a war. It sets up that.
Right.
But it doesn't do anything more than that in regards to the situation regarding the sides. It's like it's using the setting, it's using the fact that this event actually happened, even though it doesn't go out of its way to say, you know, this is based on a true story, although it is on the title card, I believe, that this is based on some books and stuff. But they don't make a big deal out of this being a true story. But what about you, Chris? Did you find yourself being affected by the fact that that we're kind of rooting for a Confederate?
No, I mean, like, not really. Like, I think it may have crossed my mind, like, when I was first watching it, but then I kind of, like, just forgot about it for a while, and then, like, wait, is he from the South? And you're just kind of like, oh, wait, it's a fucking, you know, two trains fucking chasing each other and shit, and you kind of forget about it. At the end, when you see him, like, in the uniform, you're like, oh, shit, he's from the South, you know? And I didn't even care, really. It was mostly, to me, it seemed like it was, I mean, I know he's, like, devoted to the South or whatever, but, like, in another way, it seemed like, oh, I've got to get in this uniform so I can fucking keep talking to this girl, basically.
Yeah.
So, I mean, even says that, and it's just like, don't talk to me until you're in uniform, I think is what the title card said or some shit.
Which kind of, you know, if the recruiters had just looked him in the eye and said, look, we can't take you because you're more important to the Confederacy as an engineer. You're too valuable to put in the field.
Yeah.
He might not be they told him that in front of everybody else, like, the girl's dad is there, and he's like, oh, well, I guess he is kind of valuable as that. Okay, I'll go tell my daughter that, and maybe your daughter won't be as much of a prick about it.
No, because the thing is that, especially consider the romanticization of a soldier. You know, soldiers go out and fight and kill, and, you know, it's basically like the male nurse type thing, where, yeah, it's, you know, yeah, you're the one who's hauling people and things around, but there's nothing sexy about that. There's nothing attracted by that. There's no pretty uniform. In fact, you're going to be dirty and grimy and, you know, gunky the entire time. You're not going to be doing anything very heroic. There's no songs going to be sung about you, hauling them train cars. There's nothing like that going to happen. But And that's really what it was, is that he wanted the honor. And one thing that I find that a lot of the more memorable silent films is that heroes seem, it's a shorthand that the heroes are always trying to gain the favor of a girl, whether it's something that he has to do. One of my favorite silent films is a movie called Safety Last, which is about a man who is trying to make his way into the corporate world so that he can make enough money to marry his sweetheart, Modern Times, where there's a romance that plays into that. City Lights is all about a romance. Romance is a shorthand. It's an easy way to understand why a character will do something outrageous or dangerous or foolish in order to gain favor, right? It's using that damsel, not even damsel in most cases, although this one is definitely a damsel in distress situation, But it's an easy trope, something that you'd be easy to understand, easy to connect with, and easy to go, okay, that's why. And I guess I also find it very interesting that this movie does kind of follow the hero's journey, right? We have a call to, you know, a call to rise to the occasion. His train is stolen, his girl is stolen, and he has to go get her back no matter the obstacles that are in his way. Y'all see that in the movie, right? That's a pretty straightforward approach to the, what the film is going for, right?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like, can you kind of see where this movie kind of deviates from that just a little bit, though, right?
Well, his journey begins. Well, it kind of. Well, actually, he is in a standard hero's journey. He is at a standstill for a while until something happens.
Well, it's not just that. The thing is that is he at the beginning of the movie? Is he actually a hero? Does he have any traits that come off as a heroic? You know, kind of go back to, I guess, home. To Homer, perhaps. Does he have a kind of an Achilles element or an Odysseus element to him? Does he come off as a Beowulf type character?
Not at all. So,
and we see that he's extremely clumsy. We see that he as much as he's determined, he's also very careless. So he's a fool. This is a fool that is going to be doing a hero's job, right?
In other words, it's your standard RPG adventuring party is one person. So,
I mean, okay, if we're going to go with the RPG approach, this is a guy who is constantly rolling low every time. But it's not low enough that he fails. It's just enough that he keeps rolling.
No, some of those times are failures, so not botches. Like, the cannon is a great gag.
The cannon doesn't destroy the train.
No, it's almost a botch. Almost kills him.
It almost, but it doesn't. So he isn't, but he isn't a total fail. He doesn't roll a one. I would say he probably rolls maybe a three. You know, like you could tell that it doesn't affect the train. It just misfires. It fires away, and in a way, it does enough because it scares the guys thinking that they got cannon.
Oh yeah, that or he is botching all the time. But whenever there's damage rolled against him, it ends up being nothing. He never actually gets injured by anything.
Well, no, he doesn't get injured. But at the same time, though, he's also very nimble. He does think quickly on his feet, and he keeps going forward. Even when the odds are against him, when it's just him, when he basically gets the John McClane thing, where all the forces are against him, he's up against odds that are way beyond him, and yet he has to find a way to maneuver and to outthink and outsmart his enemies, which can we all agree that they're not exactly the brightest bunch in the world? Yeah, just saying. they're not very smart. But at the same time, though, the action that's going on, the because this movie is nonstop, right? I mean, when the trains are colliding, there's things are happening almost every moment in the film, right?
Well, actually, from the time the war officially begins, yes, but. Okay, what do you mean by is happening?
Okay, let's define that. From the moment that the train is stolen, And Buster Keaton and Johnny, Buster Keaton's character is going after them. It's constantly in motion. It's constantly, perpetually moving forward in the story. The train gets stolen. He grabs a push cart. He pushes the cart. They derail the rail. He falls off. He finds another train, and it keeps moving. We have the cannon. That doesn't work. They try to, throw boards onto the track to derail the train. He deflects them, which is one of the most dangerous stunts of its time. Yeah. And the fact that Buster Keaton is doing it himself, that is impressive. That's one of the most impressive stunts I think I've ever seen. And I would put that up there with Jackie Chan. In the type of stuff that we'd expect with Jackie Chan. In fact, Jackie Chan considers Buster Keaton his influence. So that should also be said right there. But yeah, I mean, look at what he's doing, though. I mean, the way that he's jumping all over the train, he's standing up on the on the top of the train while no one is running it. He's going back and forth. He's, cutting up wood to feed the fires. He's dealing with the attacks on the train when they get people onto the train and fight them off. He's constantly having to deal with crisis. In fact, this is a movie of crisis and response. Crisis is put up, he responds to it. Crisis comes up, he responds to it. And this happens all throughout the film up until the halfway point, and then it reverses itself. He's the one that is put in the crisis towards the Union soldiers as he's trying to get back to the Confederate line. And so you have this kind of weird horseshoe element to the story, right? Because it's kind of going, it's kind of like it's the same thing that we saw the first half, only backwards. Right?
He's chasing, they're chasing him.
Well, they're chasing him, he's destroying the rails. He's trying to burn the bridge down, and all of this is happening, but just in reverse, where they were the ones that were doing this. Now he's the one that's doing this, and so he's the one that's kind of causing the crisis that they're having to respond to, which of course leads us to the massive finale at the bridge.
The battle, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, but the thing is that. Yeah, and we're gonna be looking at another movie that also has this kind of crisis and response type of thing when we get into our art house summer. This is something that is actually kind of, I don't want to say that this is the first movie that used this, but mm-hmm. I think this is one of the first movies that really accentuated the crisis, made sure that you understood what the crisis was. So that you're wondering, how is our hero going to get out of this? How are they going to deal with this? And that's something that I really appreciate about how the film edits and how the film punctuates the things that Johnny is having to go through. Right? Or do you find yourself really not caring? Did you find yourself confused about what's happening?
Well, the only part that confused me was I couldn't figure out how the Union attack plan was supposed to work. Just that it was supposed to work. But then the ending I got, I mean, he puts on a uniform, he starts directing fire with the general, and they have a battle, and yeah. And it's done with comedic effect. So.
Okay, so we actually find that out at the halfway point when Johnny finally makes it to the Union camp. He's going to try to rescue his girl, but he finds himself hiding underneath the table, which I have to admit is another great kind of crisis response scene there as well. But he finds out that what they're going to do is they're going to use his train, because his train is a Confederate train. This is right. a recognized Confederate train, and they thought that they had only a handful of people know that the train was stolen. So what they're going to do is they're going to basically Trojan horse. They're going to put a whole bunch of Union soldiers on the train, get it through the front lines, and attack them from the rear. And so basically they'll have the soldiers on the train, they'll get behind the lines, the frontal force will attack the line, and then they'll attack from behind. Because they won't be thinking about what's behind them, they'll only be thinking about what's ahead of them. That makes sense?
I'm trying to think how it would... You would need a lot of troops, otherwise, you know.
Well, that was what they're going to do. They're going to put a whole bunch of troops on that train. They were. You saw the amount of cars that they were hooking up to the train.
True.
Before he unhooks it. They were going to put soldiers on all of those cars and haul them behind the lines. You see?
Yeah. But the bit with the support trains, I didn't quite get. Was just to rearm everybody right away, but...
That's what they're there for.
Yeah.
Trains are hauling... More times than not, trains weren't hauling soldiers.
Oh, no.
They were hauling materials.
Ammunition and sometimes food.
Ammunition, food, clothing, mail, things like that. So one of the reasons why railroads were attacked as much as they were, railroads and telegraph poles were attacked, were to destroy the means of both communication and rearmament, so that it left soldiers without arms, without necessary materials, so that it affected their morale, it affected their ability to fight. You see?
Yeah.
All right. But anyway, so that was kind of the plan that was being done there. Out of curiosity, though, what did you think about how the movie used color? Now, this is not just black and white. This is extremely primitive. In fact, I almost want to say it's kind of like gold and black a little bit, right?
I thought anything like that was just an artifact I was noticing, but...
Well, it was the same kind of color scheme that we saw with Daughter of Dawn and with Birth of a Nation. Now, it should be said that Birth of a Nation came out nearly 8 years before The General came out. Hmm. So, this is a movie that has been in the... This is a movie that has been in the about the highlight of the silent movie era, just before the talkie comes around. The talkie would be out of Brown, I want to say, 1926?
Ooh.
Somewhere around there?
Yeah.
And then...
Close. Yeah.
Yeah. But... what did you think of the use of color, though? Especially like with the use of light, with night, and when they're going through tunnels and things of that nature.
I don't remember the tunnels.
I remember a tunnel. I didn't.
Okay.
I don't remember thinking much about the lack of color or anything. I kind of just went with it, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, also, there's a scene where he's underneath the table, but he uses a hole in the cloth to his girl, and to see that she is in the room, in the way that they use that kind of that. I want to say it was almost like they were using the rotoscope, or not rotoscope, but the kind of the lens closer to kind of, huh?
Now, the I think I know Iris.
Yeah.
Iris, yeah.
Yeah, you and your Stargate knowledge.
I was thinking the iris of an eye, too, but yeah.
No, I'm going to blame it on the Stargate.
Oh, fine. Okay. Yeah. Chevron 1 is locked. Chevron 2. Anyway.
All right.
Yeah.
But I do love the tricks that this movie uses in order to accentuate, not just accentuate, but to focus the attention on details and putting everything into perspective. I love the fact that this is a movie that you could definitely tell that they're using practical locations. This is in a practical environment. I want to say that they were actually like using two trains at the same time, like when they're, you know, when they're doing the train chases, where they had the camera on one train following alongside the other train, so that you could, you know. I especially love the scene where, you know, they're going beyond the Union lines, and so you'd see the retreat of the Confederate soldiers kind of going one direction while the train's going in the other, and then you saw the Union soldiers do it, kind of again reinforcing the fact that they're now behind enemy lines and making that very clear. I absolutely love that, especially just how beautiful that shot is, right? I mean, that's a pretty cool shot. You know, and it's also kind of funny because, you know, here you have a Confederate soldier basically going where none of the soldiers are going to go.
Yeah.
He's doing the one thing that they can't do, right?
Yeah.
But what about you, Chris? Well, what are you getting from the way that the shots are composed, where the staging of the action and things of that nature?
I mean, I guess I didn't take a lot of that away from when I watched it. I mean, I remember certain parts, like
did you find the way that the shots are staged to look familiar to a filmmaker that you have shown quite a bit of affinity for? Someone who loves to center all the action in the middle and utilize this kind of deep focus on everything in the background, so that it gives full range of motion throughout the scene?
No.
No. Really?
No.
You didn't see Wes Anderson's hand in or
No, not at no. all.
Wow.
Yeah.
I would have thought that you would have caught on that one.
Mm-mm.
That was pretty clear, to be honest.
Yeah.
No, but yeah, actually, go back if you get a chance. I would strongly recommend going back and watching it, kind of focusing on that aspect, because if you do look at it through that lens, the way that the shots are composed, especially at that time without the autofocus that you would normally have with, you know, newer style cameras that would be perfected both in the late 30s, early 40s, and that would kind of be more modifiable and better or easier to use later on, you know, especially in the time of Wes Anderson. But just with a primitive camera, what he is capable of doing and keeping everything into focus the way he does, so that it doesn't fade out in the background as you would normally have, and especially, like, I find myself kind of thinking back on Birth of a Nation a little bit, with just how terrible the shot composure, the shot compositions were in comparison to what was being done here. Now, granted, there's been years between that movie and this one, so it's not an apples-to-apples comparison, but I found myself just gravitating to these shots a lot more, and the way that the action was composed, and you could tell that they learned from the stuff that D.W. Griffith had done back in the in 1915 and his follow-up movies, and had taken that to the next level, you know, considering, right?
I tried to block a lot of it, but yeah, I can see, you know, just the progress of over just a few years where you could easily learn, okay, this doesn't work, but this does work, so let's do it like this, and just improved rapidly.
And another thing that should be mentioned right quick in regards to the types of shots that are being had, because most of these shots that we have here are long takes. I want to say that the average take for this movie is like, what, 25, 30 seconds is the average?
Yeah, not that long at all.
No, that's actually very long. If you think about it, most modern movies, the average take is about anywhere between
A few seconds.
15 to 20 seconds. So 35 seconds, 35 to 45 seconds, whatever, that's a long time, especially for such a short film. But also keep this in mind, like I was mentioning with the trains. If you have a train, if a camera is on a train that's rolling, even, let's say, 25, 30 miles an hour, train on a railroad track, that camera is going to shake. And there's and at that particular point, there's very little buffering that could be, or, you know, dampening that is capable of being done to keep it from shaking. And yet, a lot of those shots, while there is a little bit of shake to it, is still managing to keep everything into focus, is not, you know, tipping over, it's not moving so much that you can't, it's distracting from what's going on. In fact, most people would probably not even notice any of them, any of the shaking or any of the odd camera quirks, simply just because they're so minimal and because what's going on the camera is just so invigorating that you're paying attention to it more. Right? Or did y'all notice the type of shaking and stuff?
It is. See, I didn't.
I don't remember any shaking, honestly.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind.
Did they have a rig for that? Did they figure it out?
They would have primitive rigs, but nothing like the kind of steady cams that you would have, or, you know, the kind of fixed camera. Understand that these are crank cameras. You know, they had to crank it by hand to, you know, and it had to stay consistent. If they cranked it too much, then it would come by, or the shots would come out really slow, or, you know, it'd look like slow-mo. If they cranked it too little, then it looks way too fast. You know, it doesn't keep the correct frame rate. Right? So they had to keep it consistent, and they had to do it for very long takes. So that's another thing that you have to kind of keep in mind. See what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. All right. So those are some of the technical aspects that I found very fascinating with this particular film. Were there any technical elements to the film that you find yourself noticing or paying attention to?
Just the technical? How Buster Keaton can do stunts and not kill himself.
Well, you say that technically, with all the stunt people.
Yeah.
Those were insane stunts, especially like with the action sequences on the moving train. Well, again, there are no safety. There's no safeguards on those trains. You know, if they had fallen off, even at 30, you know, the 20 to 25 to 30 mile an hour.
That would hurt. Yeah.
Well, it could be fatal. Yeah. Considering where you fell off and how, and at they're, what trajectory.
They're not padding the sides of the tracks, so. Even though I kind of wonder if that train during the railroad tie thing is only moving about 15, maybe.
Well, they could have slow cranked it and speed it up a little bit, but even still, even if it was going 5 to 10 miles an hour, like that, you know, the way that he uses one piece of lumber to knock off the other piece of lumber, even at 5 miles an hour, if that thing goes wrong, he could have fallen off in front of the train and got ran over.
Actually, though, with the cow catcher, that should have knocked him aside. But that would still break a few bones.
Well, I don't think he'd die. Bones. Yeah. Or again, the who knows exactly how badly he could have been injured, and that goes with any of the other stunt performers. And remember that Buster Keaton pretty much. You know, that the main actors got a lot of the attention, but many of the stunt performers got no credit whatsoever. They were risking their lives, and their names wouldn't even show up on the title card. You see?
Yeah.
So, you know, when we talk about the unknown stuntman, we're definitely talking about the unknown stuntman when we come to these types of movies. And yeah, I find myself enthralled by the suspect. But what about you, Chris? What did you think about the stunt work?
I mean, I guess I was thinking about like if there was a stunt team, or if it was all, you know, Buster Keaton or whoever was there, or whatever. Because I mean, considering the time, you had to figure it was pretty much them doing all their own stuff, which only made it more impressive, you know. But like even like the like with the cannon, and like it's timed just right, so like when the train like goes around the corner, that's actually, I mean, just the timing aspect of it is, I mean, it's crazy. And just thinking that they actually did some aspect of that, not totally, it's just like, it's insanity. Like thinking about doing that today, it's just like, fuck, man. I wouldn't stick my fucking head in a cannon just to, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about it.
Yeah.
And we see that the cannon actually does fire the pellet. Mm-hmm. You know, granted only about a few feet, but you know, we do see that it fires. So that is a firing cannon. That is a cannon that is actually, in fact, you know, being loaded and being shot. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if we're going to talk about explosions, we have to talk about the finale.
Oh,
the bridge. Now, this is considered to be one of the most expensive stunts, one of the most expensive set pieces in a movie of the 1920s. What did you think about this train crash?
They actually took out the train, didn't they? An actual period train. You see, that hurts. So, as someone that grew up near trains, that hurts. So,
yeah,
if it had been a prop or a model, but yeah, it took out a real one.
If I'm not correct, they actually did it twice.
Really?
Yeah. Not the same train, mind you. I'm pretty sure they used a different train the second time.
Wow.
But yeah,
which makes me wonder if we could find that wreckage somewhere, and it's still sitting in some swamp somewhere.
Well, I'm pretty sure they had to clean it up, but
who knows?
Well, the thing is that you know, it's not perhaps a regulation, but I'm pretty sure that a community would not be too particularly happy with Hollywood just trashing your. Trashing your place and leaving the debris to be picked up. Yeah, you know, they especially if they want to come back and use that location again for other movies, or perhaps to reshoot something.
Yeah.
And this was actually shot in Oregon, which I thought was kind of interesting. I didn't really notice that this was Oregon. It definitely, I guess I really didn't pay too much attention to that aspect. But there are a lot of trees, and there are a lot of, there's a lot of forestry in, in the shots, right? Especially when you get to, like, the nighttime scenes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah.
But yeah, I thought that was just very fascinating how they did all that. But there's one other thing I do want to ask about. Now, obviously, when it comes to silent movie, there was no music that came with that movie. So the music, even like to, in the more recent reiterations of The General, they usually will get a composer to write music to go along with the movie. Out of curiosity, if you were able to do this, and understand that The General is public domain, so you could in fact do this. If you can get a composer to do a whole new score for The General, who would you pick to do a whole new score?
We'll make it a contest. Get multiple composers to do it.
Well, like in 1980... Metropolis had a whole rock score done to it.
Right.
I forgot who did it. It was one of the, one of the great rock producers of the 80s who did a whole new score for Metropolis, because it was like his all-time favorite movie. But who do you think would make a pretty awesome score for this? Now, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to go ahead and remove one name off of this just simply because it'd be too easy. So, no John Williams.
Yeah.
Can't do John. But who would you do? Or who would you have do it?
Barry McCrary.
That would be kind of cool. I think that he would definitely have a unique take on it.
We know he can do chases over long distance because we all watch Battlestar Galactica.
That is true. But Chris, do you have a choice for either a composer or perhaps a performer who you think would do a pretty awesome job?
I am not sure. No, I don't have anybody.
All right, I'm going to have to give my... The thing is my girlfriend is going to listen to this.
Oh, okay.
And if I said any other name than this one, I would probably get my butt beat. But I would have to give it to Johnny Greenwood. Especially after his scores on There Will Be Blood and Phantom Thread. Okay. I can only imagine what he would do with this material. So, or if I could like get a dream team type thing, it would be a collab between Johnny Greenwood and I can't believe I forgot his name. The guy who did the score for The Proposition and The Road.
That Nick Cave?
Yeah, Nick Cave.
Yeah.
Yeah, Nick Cave and Johnny Greenwood. Come on, that would be
good. Yeah,
that would be insane, wouldn't it? Maybe throw in some darkness and get Atticus Ross.
I was thinking maybe like Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, but I wasn't sure.
Well, I'm just like building like this dream team here. It's like I'm going completely against the whole spirit. Like at this particular point, I would get maybe Ennio Morricone to jump in, do a couple beats, get maybe a Hans Zimmer.
Mm, yeah.
Just Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
But, all right. So, I guess the last thing for me is, this is a pretty short movie, right? This, we're talking about like an hour, 15 minutes, around an hour, 15 minutes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does this film feel like it's at the right length at that amount of time, or does it feel too short? Do you think that it needed to be a little bit more to flesh it out, or do you think that it took too long? What are your opinions on the runtime?
Okay, so I've only watched it once, and maybe I wasn't in the mood or whatever. I knew it was only like, you know, 75 minutes, whatever. It felt long. It felt long to me. And I'm like, the shit, man. Come on. Not even an hour and a half. You find yourself
losing attention?
Yeah, I was getting bored with it. And I was like...
I seriously don't understand you, Chris.
I kept having distractions that kind of caused me to not be able to give 100% focus.
Do you think it was the silent nature of the film that perhaps was a detractor?
I think that did it. Because I'm used to being able to turn around, still hear dialogue behind me, come back, and I know exactly what's going on. I almost think, and I'll blame, you know, TV for this, we're kind of tuned to this hour-long variant thing, or it's... And it felt like a 90-minute show, but it felt like that, you know, 50 minutes in, you should get up, take a break, come back, and finish it off. And it isn't designed for that. It's designed to be just in one sitting. But I couldn't do it for some reason. And I wanted to. I'm not sure what was wrong.
Oh, fair enough. So, all right, well, that's it for me. Are there anything else that you want to bring up about this movie?
I did love the scene where he's guiding the cannon crews, and one by one, each number of the crew gets shot. And the last guy is completely aware. It's like, you know, if you say anything to me, why don't you fire the cannon? Bam! He's dead. Like, what? It was just... And you're a sniper. You're looking up going, huh, there's an officer talking to some guys. Oh, I'll ignore the officer and just hit the guy. It's like, what?
What about you, Chris?
Oh, I don't think I have anything else. I'm good.
Now, am I to assume that you aren't able to find anything for the Geek Sheet on this one?
I have been incredibly busy the last few days, so I was not able to even jump in very far.
But, I will only bring up one quick thing, because there is a tie between this movie and another one that we did a couple of years ago. This is not the first time that we saw Buster Keaton in a film that we've discussed. In fact, he had a short cameo in a movie set in Hollywood about an aging silent film star who went crazy. Yes, he was actually part of the poker game that Miss Desmond had put on in Sunset Boulevard.
Okay.
But yeah, he was really, he was a lot older at that particular point. You know, past his prime, definitely. But,
is he supposed to be playing himself, kind of? Okay.
Yeah, this is what cameo. It was pretty much a cameo that, you know, Desmond was palling around with her old co-stars, and he was one of them. But, yep, so that's it for Geek Sheet. So let's go ahead and call it. Kent, Chris, do you agree with the critics on The General? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Kent.
Oh, this is tough, because I kind of want to go and take a look at some of Buster Keaton's other stuff to see, because I'd heard that his shorts are actually funnier. That anytime he can kind of change the rules of what his setting is, it becomes a funnier output, a funnier joke, more comedic, and you can see where things are crafted better.
So Buster Keaton is actually the influence for Looney Tunes.
Yeah. Huh. And, which I can see there, too. Yeah. I'm like, oh, how is this film standing up to things I haven't seen? So, right now, I almost have to say maybe, but only on the grounds that if you're looking at this, your only other options are other Buster Keaton things. Maybe check them out too and see how the silent comedy works with him and then come back to this. If that makes any sense to a viewing audience. but this form, I don't know about this movie particularly. I have to maybe this particular story.
Chris,
it's maybe for me as well. I've been meaning to watch this for like fucking forever, man. Yeah. And like I think when I had like the Netflix option of like the DVD thing, I think it was in my queue for like the entire time I had that, and like I never got it. But anyway, like I finally see it, and then just some kind of I admired like the work that I went into it, and like all the stunts, and I see where Jackie Chan gets his inspiration, which I'm a huge Jackie Chan fan, so that's really cool. And I don't know, like I like certain things about it, but I didn't really like it that much, I guess. And then so it's a maybe. Yeah.
All right, so I'll be honest here. This is not one of my favorite Silent Hill film. I'm sorry, not Silent Hill. My Silent film. It's not one of my favorite Buster Keaton films. That said, though, I will say that this is possibly the most. That this is the best technical of his films, or technically one of his best films. On the technical aspect and the things that it does and the type of stunts that it does, the way that it uses the narrative the way it does. But that said, though, it definitely feels aged. And, you know, especially if you're comparing it to other action comedies that were made since then, this can be overshadowed very easily. Like I said, one of my all-time favorite silent films is a movie called Safety Last, which in my opinion does kind of the thing that this movie does, but it does it in a way that's a little bit more down to earth, and it feels a little bit more weighted in reality, where this does kind of feel like it does go off the rail at times. I am totally surprised that this was based on a true story, to be honest. That said, though, you can definitely tell that there are areas where the movie does, in fact, take liberties with that. With all that said, though, it is entertaining, and it is a bit of fun, and I do like this movie. I like it. I think that this... If someone wants to watch The General, I will watch it, and I will have a good time watching it. And I think that there is stuff here that, you know, if you're going to give silent films a shot, if you're wanting to get into this, The General is probably a good place to start, especially when it comes to silent comedies, because other silent comedies get really technically crazy, but a lot of them don't have a narrative structure that is easy to follow, and they do kind of go off in wacky tangents. The General is easy to understand. It's a very narrow focus type movie, and I respect it on that level. I'm going to give it a pass just simply for that. But like I said, this is not one of the best examples of a silent film, in my opinion. But for a first time, if you're going into this for a first time, this is a pretty good place to start. But now we're going to get off of the craziness of some slapstick visual comedy, and we're going to kind of, we're going to be looking at some crazy music a little bit. But at this particular point, if you have anything you'd like to talk to us about, you can certainly do so on our Facebook page as well as on Twitter at Art House Legends. Or if you want to send us a nice little comment, or maybe a not so nice little comment through email, you can do so at arthouselegends@gmail.com, and we will get back to you as soon as possible. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me for this episode. This is the Movie Dude Eric.
This is Kent.
And this is Chris.
And Feet.